Okay, good evening everybody, and welcome. It is 8:30 and we're going to begin. Thank you for, first of all, thank you for joining us. I know I am personally very excited about that which we're about to embark on. I'm a little overwhelmed, actually very overwhelmed. I've been thinking about it a lot over the last couple of weeks. Ironically, the thought to embark on such a venture actually came to me one day during davening, which is actually part of the problem that I'd like to discuss. But I've been thinking about it a lot since. And I'd like to begin by saying, I'm sure everybody here joins me in the special excitement and anticipation that we have as we watch the building right next door go up before our eyes. It's just a matter of days before the wall that separates the two buildings come down. And we're going to be seeing, hopefully, in the next couple of months, a very, very beautiful, enhanced, expanded, renovated facility. And the choice to devote ourselves during this interim period to growth in tefillah is not coincidental, very deliberate on my part, and I hope that you'll agree that to the extent that we could prepare ourselves, and as you may have perhaps seen, yeah, as we tried to convey through the marketing and the flyer, to the extent that we can renovate our tefillos and broaden our souls and sort of beautify our hearts directly through our prayer, so that when that day comes, hopefully in the near future, that we are ready to move in to our new expanded facility, that we will have earned it in that way, and that we can even before we begin, we could sort of justify, if you will, the tremendous chesed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has bestowed upon this community, enabling us. But again, the Beis HaKnesses is a very important part of our lives, but the heart and soul of the Beis HaKnesses is our tefillah, is our prayers, and so therefore it's dafka at such a time that I think it's most appropriate that we devote ourselves to this topic. Iyun tefillah, which is, I guess, loosely translated as a very, very careful analysis and study and thought and introspection regarding tefillah, is one of the things that Chazal tell us requires chizuk all the time. It's something that requires constant focus and attention and diligence. And perhaps we could take a measure of comfort knowing that Chazal already pointed out that if you're human, then you're going to struggle with prayer. And it's a lifetime of effort that's really necessary, and we have to continuously maintain our attention, our focus, and our growth in prayer. And I have to say that the fact that you're here this evening is already a tremendous sign, because it means that you recognize just this very fact, that there's room for growth and there's an area for improvement. I'd like to begin, even before tonight's introductory share, with telling you what we're not going to be doing over here. And I'm going to put this out from the beginning, because I've actually struggled a lot, even the last few days, preparing what I'm going to share with you tonight. For everything that there is to say, or that we're going to discuss tonight, there are hundreds of other things that we could and really need to discuss. But in order that we remain focused and sort of stay on task, I'll tell you what we're not going to do. We're not going to be devoting ourselves at all to the laws of tefillah. Hilchos tefillah, the laws of tefillah, are very important for study. One cannot properly pray to God if one does not know the laws of prayer. We've discussed the laws of prayers in the past, actually between Mincha Ma'ariv every day, that happens to be what we're doing now. And we'll continue to do so in other forums, and I'm happy to suggest to anyone, please let me know if any individuals over here are interested in me directing you towards places and sources that you can study Hilchos Tefillah. Yes?
I would suggest that the Roman press has a new safe out in English by the Bobrovsky.
Okay, wonderful.
It's available at Danica House, and they have during February they match the state.
Okay, wonderful. So again, there are books available.
It's a 30% off.
Okay, so there are books available, and they may be at a tremendous discount specifically at this time. So thank you, Rabbi Frazier. But we will not be, again, we will not be studying the laws of prayer. That being said, if in, you know, in the course of our discussions, if you have a question, if something comes to mind, particularly as it relates to that which we're discussing, obviously I'm happy to discuss any issue as it relates to the topics that we will be studying. But this is not, by design, this is not going to be a study of the laws of tefillah. Additionally, and this may be somewhat surprising, and I hope not to disappoint anyone, but we're not going to be discussing the importance of prayer, the centrality of tefillah in our lives, and the need for prayer, and to how the and how prayer has been built into nature. Kadosh Baruch Hu created a world in which things can only operate smoothly if we are in fact praying. There are so many important, very, very fundamental ideas and concepts and issues relating to prayer that we could and should discuss. But again, in order to that we could stay focused and really try to tend to Shmoneh Esrei, certainly ideas will come forth, but that is not going to be our focus. Similarly, not going to be focusing on great philosophical questions that probably bother your mind, as they do mine. Does Hashem really need our prayers? Doesn't He know what we really want anyway? So why do we have to ask for it? What's the point of asking if He's going to decide what He wants to do? No doubt, as we begin to work our way through Shmoneh Esrei, and we hopefully will develop a more, forgive me, a more mature understanding of what the purpose of prayer is, and how in fact we are to relate to the brachos, and what it means when we are asking Hashem for something. So hopefully a lot of these questions will maybe not seem as pressing as they do at the moment, and maybe directly or indirectly we will address them. But again, these sorts of questions are extremely important, and I certainly encourage you once again to explore on your own, and I'm happy to direct you again. That's not going to be what we are going to be focusing upon. Rather, as is indicated in the flyers announcing tonight's shiur, our focus for the next few months, I imagine at least, is going to be to explore Shmoneh Esrei, or perhaps more accurately, the Amida, the service in which we daven to Hashem three times a day, four times a day on other days, and of course in Yom Kippur five times a day. And our focus is going to be to develop on a broad level, and then on perhaps somewhat more of a specific level, a greater degree of comfort and understanding and appreciation of these very, very important timeless words that we say each and every day. Tonight's shiur is going to be an introduction to Shmoneh Esrei. We're not actually going to be analyzing any particular bracha tonight, but tonight is going to be an introduction which I think is necessary, because, as I'll explain in a moment, there are certain very, very important points which need to be stated before we even begin to attempt to try to arrive at a point where we can discuss Beir HaTfila and understanding and appreciation of the words that we say when we daven. It's very, very difficult to begin this, I must tell you, because you know, there are so many places in which we can start and reflect. And it's really with a tremendous amount of reverence and even trepidation, and I don't mean to sound melodramatic, that I'm going to begin with you, but we're going to begin right now with the first source. And the first source is a pasuk that is familiar to each and every one of us. It comes from the Shema that we say daily. And it shall be that if you listen to the mitzvot that I command to you to do today, to love Hashem your God, and to serve Hashem, to worship Hashem with all of your hearts and all of your souls. Now we know that as Jews, we are required to serve Hashem constantly throughout the day, and we use many different parts of our body to serve Hashem. I think it's fair to say that over the course of a year, pretty much every single part of our body is used in the service of Hashem, literally without exception. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu demands and wants from us complete and total devotion. And there's not one part of our being, our physical being, our emotional being, our spiritual being, that is somehow exempt, that is not required to contribute in this way to form a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is a pasuk that we say each and every day, but perhaps we fail to appreciate how profound it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that He wants us to serve Him with our hearts. Well, with kier, we understand that, of course, we don't speak necessarily about the physical heart, but the heart represents, of course, the emotional part of man. Heart represents the psyche of man, all of our fears, all of our desires, all of our interests, our dreams, our urges. This is all contained within Lev. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I want you to serve me with your heart. Now, how do you serve Hashem with your heart? By eating matzah? No. By putting on tefillin? No. By refraining from doing malacha on Shabbos? No. Says the Gemara in Tanis, in the source, second source, Uminolon de betfila. How do we know that we have an obligation to pray? As it says, La'avot Hashem lokechem uliyavdo b'chol levavchem, eizohu avodah shehi b'lev, havyomer zot tefila. Says the Gemara, what is avodah shebelev? How do you serve Hashem with your heart? And the answer is through prayer. Now again, in order that we can succeed, hopefully, sort of breaking through, and I think that you understand what I'm saying when I use that term, the way that we're accustomed to viewing prayer, because each and every one of us are here because we're looking to improve in our prayer. We're not here because we've never opened a siddur before. We're looking to sort of have a new perspective on things. So we really, really need to sort of come to grips with that expression. And it's one, like I said, that I've really been sort of, you know, pressuring myself a lot over the last few days in particular to really come to grasps with that term of avodah shebelev. And it's very difficult, particularly as a Torah observant Jew, because as Torah observant Jews who follow the laws of tefillah, so we know that tefillah is actually very structured, and it's very formal, and it's very regimented, and we're told what to say, when to say it, when to stand, when to sit, when to bow, when not to bow, when you can talk, when you can't talk, when to answer, when not to answer. And with all of these laws, and all of the rigidity, and the seemingly inflexibility of prayer, it could rob us, if we're not paying close attention, it could rob us of the opportunity that not only we have, but that we are required to take advantage of, and that is to serve Hashem with our hearts. Because while it's true that in order to be engaged in prayer in an active sense, there are things I need to say, and there's a position that I need to have, and there's posture and there's movement, and there's steps forward and there's step back, steps backwards, but all of this is just the context. All of this is just the shell. But really what prayer is all about is heart. And I'm not going to say it's you, I'm not going to say it's me, but I'm sure that everyone here can imagine, if you will, a person who comes to shul, a man or a woman, a child, it doesn't matter, and knows exactly when to stand, when to sit, opens the book to the right place, says the right words, but somehow the heart isn't there. And it's so unfortunate because there's so much that's missing. One could argue that the prayer at that point is not even a prayer, because the Torah again defines prayer as avodah shebelev. It's something that requires heart, and one of the great challenges and one of the things that we're really going to try to overcome in our studying together is that we should not lose sight of the forest. We should not lose sight of what we're really, really trying to accomplish and to gain through tefillah, despite the fact that formal, structured, rigid prayer, which has incredible advantages, which is something that we must do, does sort of set us at a disadvantage if we don't pay close attention. I want to just share with you one other source before we talk specifically about Kavanah and prayer. And this is one that I just came across a few weeks ago, and I actually mentioned it as Shalosh Shudas and Shul, some of you may have heard, just a few weeks ago. But it was something that I stumbled upon because it's based on a Mishnah which is actually not on the sheet in front of you, but there's a Mishnah in Maseches Brachos, I believe it's Daf Chaf Ches and Beis, which teaches that when a person makes a mistake in his davening, so the Lashon of Mishnah is, this is a Siman Ra. That if a person is davening and makes some sort of error, and it may be a question what qualifies as an error and who this individual is, so I don't want to scare anyone over here, but the Mishnah seems to imply in its most simplistic level that if a person is davening and messes up, you know, says the wrong thing, forgets to insert the proper thing, so this is a siman ra. That this is not a very good sign. This means that something's not right. This has always bothered me. What does it mean that something's not right? What do you mean? He messes up. You know, we all had to like make mistakes. And after all, you know, from time to time, I'm going to forget to say Yalav Yov. I'm going to forget what day it is. I'm going to daven a weekday, davening on Shabbos. Is it the end of the world? Is it really a siman ra? So the source that I have in front of me and you, in source number 3, actually does not is not addressing this point directly, but I think it addresses it indirectly. And it's a quote. It's actually not a direct quote, but it's a paraphrase of sorts from the Chida. And it says Ukfar Amru, and it's already previously been stated. And the one that's being quoted over here is the Chida Shahatfila Kimmar'e. That tefila is like a spiegel, a mirror. Im zach v'yasher pa'alo b'tovr masin tovim u'ma'asa'o matano be'emuna azai tefilaso b'kavana u'kohoge. That if a person is living a spiritually enriched life, in which they are engaged in acts of kindness and chesed, and they're dealing properly with other people, and they're honest in their business, and they're just wholesome, good, fine individuals, so then, by extension, they will see that through their prayer. But if a person, unfortunately, is struggling in their prayer, and if a person does not necessarily find any satisfaction in their prayer, that may be an indication that something's not right. Now, there are two ways of looking at this. One, I think, is a little overwhelming, maybe frightening to some, and says, wait a second, I thought I was a pretty good person, and here, you know, the one thing in my life I struggle with is prayer. So now you're telling me that that's just a sin and that everything else is broken? So I don't know that we need to take it quite to that extent, and certainly the last thing I want to do is upset anybody by sharing this particular source. But I looked at it, you know, from somewhat a different perspective, and that is that a way that we could perhaps evaluate, gauge, measure our spiritual health is through our tefillah. And that may be something that's painful to look at, but we're here for a reason. And, you know, let's be big and mature about this. And again, I'm not going to take hands. I'm not going to ask you how you think you met. But if you want to know how hot in the room it is, you know, you take a look at the thermometer. You could measure air pressure with a barometer, I think, right? Is that what a barometer measures? Good. If you want to measure the degree of spiritual health that you have, so perhaps the best way to do it is by gauging the effectiveness of your prayer. And we say, when I speak about effectiveness, I don't just mean, you know, how many things you ask for that you actually get, because that's absolutely not what tefillah is about. But if I feel that when I come to shul, or if I daven at home, whatever the case is, if I feel that after my tefillah, I feel that I've been elevated, I feel that I've been enriched, I feel that I've literally been able to connect with the divine, so that's an indication that things are well. Doesn't mean things are perfect, it doesn't mean there's no room for improvement, but that's a good sign. It means that there is in fact a connection, and therefore I derive even a greater sense of satisfaction, of meaning, when I can focus in the most intimate way on that relationship with the divine through prayer. But if I come to shul and I don't feel that connection, if I come and I feel very awkward, and there's just no connection that's being made, that may mean more than just, you know, I don't really understand what's happening over here, but it may mean that, you know, there's a greater problem, and there's a greater gap in this relationship, one that needs to be filled. And ironically, the greatest way to address that is through prayer itself. You know, this is a conversation that I've had many times with my students who are younger than most of the people here, but in trying to gently persuade, because the one thing that I would never force demand of anyone, certainly my students who are relatively young, can't force them to daven. I would never force them to say words. I would never force them to, you know, encourage them. But in through courses of discussion and gentle persuasion, so very often I'll be told, well, you know, if I don't find davening meaningful, so then why should I do it? You know, when I find it to be meaningful, so then I'll daven more. But what I've obviously tried to encourage my students to consider is you're going about this the wrong way. If you give over of yourself, try to cross this divide and go into a place that you've never gone to before, so then you will find that is actually a satisfying experience, that it's fulfilling, and then you go on more and more of it. But if you're going to wait, so to speak, for God to, you know, extend his hand to you and pull you in, but you're not willing to, you know, take that first step, or at least meet him halfway, you know, forgive me for all these metaphors over here, but, you know, if we're not willing to do anything, and we're just going to wait to be swept away, so then we may spend our entire life waiting for that moment, which unfortunately may never come. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu does ask of us, U'liyavda b'cholavavchem, that we are to serve him with our hearts, and that requires at least some initiative on our part. Now, When we talk about Kavana, and we're going to talk specifics in a moment, I think there's an important disclaimer that I'd like to begin with. And this is something that will hopefully make all of us feel a little better. And that is, we're going to be spending probably the rest of this year, of this evening, talking about Kavana and what it means and what it is, because I think, again, it's a necessary discussion that we must have before we actually talk about the specifics of Shemoneh Esrei. But I think it's important for everyone to realize that despite what I've said until now, and despite what you may have heard or read, I think that a case could be made that even tefillah without Kavana, or very, very little Kavana, is still worth something. And I would feel terrible if anybody thought, certainly because of the presentation this evening, that if they've been davening until this time, you know, for most of their life, for all of their life, for some of their life, with virtually no connection whatsoever, that it's all been a waste. And I think that is that's you know, not the proper perspective to have. I think that we should realize and appreciate that the structure, the words, the format of our Shemoneh Esrei is divinely influenced very much. It was inspired by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, composed by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, which was comprised of great sages and even prophets, and merely saying the words, even if I have very, very little understanding of what I'm saying, is something that must have incredible significance. Additionally, the fact that we go through the motions of using our mouths and thereby taking advantage of the greatest endowment that man has, namely the ability to speak, and using it by turning to our Creator and speaking to Him, is already an incredible thing. And even if I haven't yet committed my lave to that process, even if I haven't been able to cross that divide, the fact that I've been doing this is not a small thing, and it's something that we should not in any way minimize. And along this line, I came across a very fascinating statement in the Nefesh HaChaim, which is not on your sheet, but I'll read it to you. He writes, "V'chol hakavanos v'hasodo shenizgalu al atfil ad hayom." All of the meanings and hidden secrets and intentions that have been revealed regarding tefillah to this very day, Einam ketipa min hayam agadol neged hakavana shehisig hakatan me'aviyasim zakenim. All this represents is like one drop in an ocean keneged the smallest, if you will, of all of the 120 people who actually compose the Shemoneh Esrei. And he says, and even a great, great gadol, a great individual, can only really understand and appreciate tefillah in accordance with his abilities at that particular moment. Which means that the words that we're saying have such incredible depth. They represent such a broad and vast world that merely just saying the words and not fully appreciating them is something. And it's not something that should be taken lightly. And we shouldn't beat ourselves up too much. We should obviously strive to improve. And we always want to, we should always demand more of ourselves, but we shouldn't be too discouraged before we begin. I would say that this disclaimer that I just mentioned, I guess, presupposes that a person is not davening in a way that would be, like Chazal have an expression, kekof ba'alma, which means like a monkey. I mean, a guy jumping up all over the seats, but in other words, there has to be, you know, a person comes to shul and says, okay, now I'm going to daven. You know, there's at least on an intellectual level, I'm here to pray to God. With that, and opening a siddur and saying words, a person is accomplishing something. Certainly accomplishing something. And it would be very unfortunate, tragic, for a person to say, you know what, I don't really understand what I'm saying, and so therefore I'm not going to say it anyway. We shouldn't have that attitude. But we're here tonight because we want more, and that's hopefully what we're going to achieve. Now, when we say kavana, intention, concentration of prayer, well, many different ways to translate the word kavana. It probably doesn't mean concentration. To be mechaven something means to direct. So, I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but let me know if you have a suggestion. I'll be happy to take any suggestions from the audience before I tell you what I think. When I say the word kavana, right? We've heard the word so many times, we've used the words, we've been told, you know, you have to have kavana, I don't have kavana, he has kavana, she has kavana. What does that mean? What does it mean to have kavana when you daven? What do you mean when we say that? Any suggestions?
Respect.
Respect. Respect for what?
Respect for what you're going to say.
Okay. Respect for what I'm going to say. Yeah?
Intention.
Meaning?
That you're intent on getting some kind of connection.
Okay, good. So I intend to get a connection, yeah.
Listening to what you're saying.
Okay, good. Paying attention. Yeah?
Being in the zone.
Being in the zone. Okay, very good. So respect, intention, paying attention, being in the zone.
Concentration.
Okay. All great answers. And, you know, probably we're probably all saying more or less the same thing. But Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was, of course, the Rav's grandfather, the great Reb Chaim wrote a famous sefer on the Rambam called, of course, Chiddushei Rabbi Nachaim Halevi. And in Reb Chaim's sefer, the very first, actually it's not the first, the second piece that he has on the sefer, a very, very famous discussion he has on that which appears to be a contradiction in the Rambam. I'm going to say most of this outside, not inside. But the Rambam appears in two places in Hilchos Tvila to contradict himself. In one place, the Rambam seems to imply that a person must have kavana for the entire prayer. When I say prayer, I mean Shmon Esrei. A person has to have kavana for the entire Amidah. And if at any point he doesn't have kavana, so then he did not fulfill his obligation of prayer. Another place, the Rambam seems to state explicitly that it's only necessary that a person has kavana for the first bracha. Of course, the Rambam doesn't suggest that we stop there, but if you're going to ask me, you're going to push me against the wall and say, but I had kavana for the first bracha, okay, you had it for the first bracha, fine. That is sufficient. So this is obviously incongruous. It doesn't add up. Which one is it? Do you have to have kavana the whole time? Or is it sufficient if you had kavana merely for the first bracha? So Reb Chaim dealt with this in a most incredible way. And he basically, you know, I was going to say following the brisket derech, because he created the brisket derech, but that which we know is the brisket derech, which is very often to take a look at something and show that we're comparing two different things we're looking at something as if it's one thing, actually two different things. He explained that there are two different types of kavana. And both of them must be considered within the context and our discussion of prayer. But there are two different types. One of them is what he calls, and actually take a look, we'll look at this together. This is in source number 4. V'nira lomar, v'trei gavnei kavanos yesh b'tfila. Says Reb Chaim, it would seem that we should come to the conclusion that there are actually two different types of prayer. Two different types of kavanah prayer. Ha'achas kavanos o'perish ha'dvarim. One of them is to understand the explanation or the translation, the definition of the words that I'm saying. V'yisodahu din kavana, and this really is an important element of kavana. V'sheinis, and the second type of kavana, shi'chavein shu omeid b'tfilah lefnei Hashem, that a person has a cognizance and awareness that is he's standing before God. And he says, k'mavur b'dvarav perek dalet, as the Rambam writes, umahi kavana. What is kavana? Says the Rambam, shiyafane es libo mikol hamachshavos. The person has to first of all clear his heart of all other thoughts at that moment. V'yira atzmo ki'ilu omed b'fnei hashchina, and imagine as he's standing before the divine. V'nira the kavana zu enim edin kavana rakshu mi'etzem masa hatfila. V'ein libo panoi v'ein roes atzmo shomed b'fnei Hashem and mispala ein zemas hatfila v'areyu b'chlam es asik inbo din masa. What did Reb Chaim just say? That if a person davens to God, stands in prayer, and does not have that awareness, does not have that sense, that perception that I'm standing before God, so says Reb Chaim, I'm really sorry, but that's not davening. And the way he says it, in a most technical way, that's not a massive tefillah. Tefillah, like every other mitzvah, or most other mitzvahs, has what we call a massa, an action, and you can't say I davened if you did not have that awareness. I didn't know what the words meant. You know, I had an English sitter, but I wasn't looking inside, or there was none available, and I was just reading the words. Then there's room to negotiate. Then explains Reb Chaim, the Rambam would say, if you understood the first bracha, we could live with that. Again, you shouldn't stop there, but at least b'dyeved, if you can ask me, okay, you fulfilled the mitzvah shemana, you fulfilled the mitzvah davening, even if you don't understand everything that you're saying. After all, we're all human. There's room for negotiation. But you can't daven before God and at any point during that prayer, you know, lose that awareness, that perception that I'm standing before God. Now again, even here, I think we must issue a disclaimer within Reb Chaim, which Reb Chaim himself may not be molded to, so I'm just saying this in a way to sort of, you know, throw a lifesaver out to you, so nobody should be, you know, it's almost impossible to daven an entire prayer without being distracted from time to time. I mean, that's part of what it's all about, and that's one of the challenges we face, and something that takes time to perfect, but probably one could never completely master. Well, I shouldn't say never, but it may be almost impossible. So we shouldn't think that if any point, you know, my mind wanders, that's it, I'm out. But I can't have it both ways. I can't say that I'm davening, but I'm completely out to lunch. That my mind is completely elsewhere, and I have no perception, no feeling, no awareness, no sense that I'm being omid of Neashchina. And the way Chaim says that so importantly is that's not davening. It's not that I'm davening, but I'm not doing it in the most complete form. That's not a masat tefillah. Masat tefillah means at the very least there has to be that awareness. Why is this so fascinating? So in the Sefer Ali Shur, in source number 5, Revolver writes that, and I'm just going to read it outside in English because to save time over here. First, in the first paragraph, he mentions this famous novel idea of Chaim that there are two different types of kavana. And he says, what's so fascinating about this is that you could have a person who does not really know the words that he's saying, does not really know what they mean, but as long as he has this intention, and Sariva, I'll go with your expression, if he's in the zone, so masat fila biyado, so then he has, in a sense, engaged in an action of prayer. This is prayer. However, ironically, and get ready for this, because I mean, maybe see it coming, you could have another person who knows 100% what he's saying. He understands all the words, and not only does he understand what they mean, but he studied this book, that book, and this book, and he has some beautiful, beautiful Torahs in each and every one of these words. This one means this, and this is that, and the gematria, and the number of letters, and the bracha, and the whole thing comes to light in his mind. But if he does not have the awareness that he's standing before God, so Rav Ob writes, that's not tefillah. What is it? He said, maybe you can call it Talmud Torah. I got the chills when I heard that. Because we have to call it something. If a guy comes to shul and he opens up a sitter, and he's he's having the time of his life, and this beautiful, beautiful prayer, and these gorgeous words, and I remember this pshat, and my third grade Rebbe told me this, and it fits in with the Gemara I learned at Daf Yomi yesterday, and he walks out of shul feeling great. What did he just do? He learned Torah. That's what he did. He learned Torah, but that's not a masat fila. A masat fila means in the zone. And in the zone means that I'm standing with Nei HaMelech. And he goes on to say it's so unfortunate, because in the last paragraph he says, Lech Chazi Ma'am Adavar, which means, take a look what the people do. When most people go about wanting to improve in tefillah, what do? Simas Libam Sharov Bnei Adam Tefillah Hu LePirushan Shel Tefillah Satefillah. Most of us approach prayer by trying to buy books which explain to us what tefillahs mean, which is important. But that approach, he says, is a little backwards, because it's Ba'od Shehakavana Lamasat Tefillah in a Baruch Kolkach. Many people do this before they're really clear and they really understand what it means to just stand and daven. And maybe they don't think about what davening is all about before they're running to understand what everything means. So he says, when I'm going to talk about prayer, we're going to do it the other way. First, we're going to talk about kavana. First, we're going to talk about what it means to be omed lefnei melech and how a person can try to achieve that level. And then, and only then, can we talk about what the brachos mean. And again, it's... you can't have one without the other. But we dare not, says Rav Ovadia, just bringing Rav Chaim to its logical conclusion, we dare not go ahead and devote ourselves exclusively to understanding what the prayers mean and forget about what it's really all about, namely to be omed lefnei HaMelech. In source number 6, I came across a very fascinating quote from Aaron Lichtenstein, which is found in an article which is titled over here. And he writes, and you know, it's English, so maybe you'll appreciate a little bit, but again, it may sting a little more than if you were reading in Hebrew. I believe, says Aaron Lichtenstein, that the sin lurking at the door of the centrist Orthodox or religious Zionist community, the danger which confronts us and which we need to be fully aware, is precisely the danger of shichacha, which means literally forgetfulness, but he's talking about shichacha in the most general sense in terms of a person forgetting about their relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Unlike other communities, this is a community that is not so susceptible to Avodah Zarah in its extension. Attitudes the Rambam battled against, such as superstition and gross or primitive conceptions of God, because this community, which is our community, I believe, is more sophisticated intellectually, religiously, and philosophically. Unfortunately, however, it is very susceptible to extended kafira of shichacha. Kafira means heresy. Lacking the imminent sense of God felt so deeply, keenly, and pervasively in other parts of the halachically committed Jewish world. It's okay. Still many, many months till Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but we could take a little musa tonight. Navan Lichtenstein said, you know, speaking to our community, what he defines as a centrist Orthodox religious Zionist community, look out. Because here's a tremendous, tremendous threat that we face, that threatens our religious growth and health, if not survival. And that is what he calls the danger of shichacha, meaning being able to, as we said, come to shul, daven, and daven can be a very enriching, sophisticated, intellectual experience, but something's missing. And what's missing is that feeling, that connection that I'm standing before the divine. So why is it so difficult? Why is it so hard for a person to come to shul and actually concentrate? And the answer, I believe, is because we all come to shul with a lot on our minds. We all live very busy lifestyles, and I dare say, but I think it's true, that it may be, you know, it's always nice to think that things are harder for us than it was for our parents, but I really think that it's very possible that if it was difficult for our grandparents to daven in shul and for them to concentrate, and difficult for our parents, it's probably much, much more difficult for us. Because we've created lifestyles for ourselves in which we are constantly bombarded with so many messages of all different sorts coming our way, flooding our mind, our imagination, our thoughts. We are so overstimulated that many of us find it difficult, if not impossible, to, you know, and I mean this only in a figurative sense at the moment, to turn it off. And we're expecting too much of ourselves to come to shul and just to be able to go ahead and snap a finger and just boom. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen someone being been hypnotized. I remember a couple of times I've seen this. It's quite fascinating. Some guy goes ahead and he talks to somebody for a few minutes. He says a few words and then he snaps the finger and boom, the head goes down like that. That would be very nice if we could just walk at the shul and we get in line and somebody says a few words and boom and doop, now I'm ready to daven. It would be wonderful. But that's not realistic. That's not the way it works. And so therefore, I ask you to consider the possibility that we may be asking too much of ourselves. So if it's impossible, then we have no choice but to try to come up with creative solutions. Most of the solutions, which I would suggest, are not new ones. They're not new solutions, but they're things that we must sort of come to grips with and be willing to try. I think we need to be honest with ourselves. I'll be willing to tell you that although it's hard to quantify these things, I'm willing to tell you, I'll say this, I'll admit to you publicly that on an average day, I think that if I'm really, really receiving a thank you in the zone, I'm probably giving 5% of myself. That's on a good day. I don't want to tell you what I'm giving on a bad day. On a really, really good day, I mean, you know, when either I really need something very badly, or I haven't been that distracted, or for some reason we're just feeling a stronger connection, so maybe I'm giving 10%. There have been points in my life, like all of us, where we've really, really needed to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have felt almost a natural draw to Him. And even then, you know, what am I giving Him? What am I giving? I remember when I was in yeshiva, there was somebody. Actually, he was first in Karen Avne and then later in YU, so I probably tracked him for about 3 or 4 years. I wasn't spying on him. I wasn't looking over his shoulders. Everyone saw him. He was a guy who davened Shemon Esrei every single day for 90 minutes, every Shemon Esrei. So you did the math, you know, and on a weekday he davened. He was standing in Shemon Esrei for 4.5 hours. I have no idea what he was doing. I have no clue. I never once asked him, you know, what are you saying for 90 minutes? But I know one thing, that in all those years, at one point I never see him open his eyes and look around. You never saw him falling asleep, as you would expect to see from time to time, or as, you know, sometimes I'll even do in the middle of davening, go ahead and see who's calling me, and pick up my phone and say, what did I miss? That here was a guy for 90 minutes, was completely in it. I can tell you that I do recall situations in my own life in which I finished my Esrei, and I realized things happened around me that I didn't even realize. People left the room. You know, someone started speaking. You know, I'll have to admit that those moments are few and far between, and I'm not looking for your sympathy, but it's not easy when you're standing up there and you have 400 people who are looking and waiting for you to finish. It just adds to the pressure and it makes it much more difficult for me to sort of slip into a world where I'd like to go. I'm not blaming it on you. It's all my fault. But, you know, we all feel various pressures. But there are so many things that are pulling us back. If we would only go ahead and learn to sort of let go and to leave the world behind. So there's a very, very beautiful world that lies just on the other side. But I'm afraid that there's no easy answer. There's no quick fix. There's no solution. There's no source that I can show you that's going to say, okay, here's how to do it. It requires a person knowing him or herself, knowing what distracts me most, and knowing, therefore, how to prepare. The Mishnah tells us that the Hasidim HaRishonim, a group of very, very pious individuals who lived centuries ago, who used to prepare for every davening by engaging in focus and meditation, preparation for that which Chazal say was a Sha'achas. Now, we can define Sha'achas as an hour, a half hour, 10 minutes, however you want to. We could argue from today till tomorrow. The bottom line is, they sat before davening and did nothing but just clear their mind. It's a very good idea. I'll be the first to admit, it's a major investment for most of us. It means not only coming to shul, or again, preparing wherever I'm going to daven, but setting aside additional time beforehand to do nothing other than focus. But I can also tell you that the payoff is immense. And if you've never tried it, you should. I'm speaking to myself. If we could only just stop, and for a few moments beforehand, engage in nothing other than just trying to focus myself, and just tune out everything else and tell myself that whatever it is that's so important right now can wait a few minutes. And don't just turn your phone on vibrate. Of course your phone has to be on vibrate, because it dare not ring in shul when other people are going to be disturbed by it. But turning on vibrate's not enough. And you know why. Turn it off. Turn it off completely, or put it on silent so you won't feel it, you won't know when it's ringing. And I promise you, President Obama needs you. He will find you. But the world will be fine. The world will be fine. It's sometimes very humbling to me when I find myself in a place where I go cell service and my battery dies and I think like the whole world's going to explode because, you know, no one knows where I am for 10 minutes. And then, you know, you get your phone again. I didn't even get one message. It's okay. And the world will go on without us. But turning it off beforehand is extremely, extremely important. When I say turn it off right now, I'm not only talking about the phones. That's just one element. Additionally, I suggest that people, and this is a sort of, again, a sort of different ideas, maybe they're obvious, maybe you do it already, maybe you don't. If you've been using one sitter your whole life and you like it, so by all means, far be it for me to convince you to, you know, to stop or to change. But it could very well be that the sitter that you've been using for the last 20 years is a little outdated. It could be that it's time and it's important for you to go ahead and buy yourself a new sitter. About 10 years ago, maybe a little more than that, when Art School produced the, what do they call it, the interlinear sitter, I got very excited about it. And I got one for myself. I've already gone through two of them because I've worn it through. But I wish I were getting it today for the first time again, because as much as I wouldn't give it up at this point for anything, and it's not only just the translation, it's because I feel like it, you get to count every word. It just gives you, it reminds you constantly, and you just need to stop. You know, over time, we become, you know, used to the same sitter in front of us, and sometimes changing to the sitter, finding a conducive place in shul to daven, there are sometimes that people are disturbed in the place that they sit. And they feel, you know, I've been sitting here 5 years, 10 years, and I shouldn't have to move just because people around me talk. Again, in a perfect world, no one would talk in shul. But we don't live in a perfect world. In the world in which we live in, there are certain places in the shul that would be more comfortable for me. It may be worthwhile to consider, again, if there's one person who's just talking, there may be other ways to deal with it. But it may be worthwhile to consider, you know, changing the seat that I've loved, that I've sat in all these years, that I watched my children growing, and moving a few rows over. If that is going to give me an edge, if that will make it easier for me to go ahead and to, as we've been saying, sort of get in the zone. Rebbe writes that the most, the biggest, the most significant impediment that we have in tefillah is what he calls gaiva. Take a look at source number 12. We're going to skip for a moment and we'll come back. He writes the following. If you take a look at source number 12, so first he starts off saying, he quotes the rush, that when it comes time to daven, yaniach kol asakav yistal, a person has to put away all of his various troubles and issues and things that he's thinking about and just daven. So he said, how am I supposed to just go ahead and let go of everything? It's not so easy. So he says, be a deal with the knowledge that even the things that I'm thinking about require tefillah, requires God's assistance, and so therefore I know it's good for me. I'm going to stop thinking about business during davening, because what I really need to do to be successful in business is to daven. Okay. Then he goes on to say, kasha lehisrachez, it's difficult to concentrate. That's something we say to ourselves all the time. Demyonos, machshavos, mafim, there are things that bother me. So he says, this is a simon that I have not yet succeeded in letting go. Because if I would only let go, then I would be able to concentrate on davening. You know, God is a wonderful person to speak to if I can concentrate on it. But if I can't, then it's impossible. And he says in the end of this paragraph, Nekot klala biyadecha, which means, hold on to this in your hand, because here's what it comes down to. Hamafriya ha'ikari betfila hu gava. The number one obstacle, the number one impediment in prayer is gaiva, which means arrogance. He says, behind all of the things that are bothering me and that are taking away from my ability to concentrate, omed ha'adam ha'machshev es'atmo v'esorot. It's a person who thinks only about himself and that nothing else in the world is important. Again, these are tough words, I apologize, but it's not that what I'm involved with is bothering so much. El ha'adam ro es'atmo b'merkaz ha'olam. A person sees himself at that moment, I'm the center of the world. And everything that is important to me, ikor kiyum ha'olam, this is the most important thing. You shouldn't think, he writes, that gaiva is just like a bad midah, it's a bad trait. Stam adam bal gavahu, the way God made us is that we tend to be self-centered. That's the way we are. We're egotistic. That's the way God made us. But until we are willing to face up to that part of our humanity and understand that that's not the right approach, that the world doesn't revolve around me, and understand how important, how liberating it could be for a person to be mbatal himself, which means just to submit myself before God, you'll see that everything that's driving me, all the things that I say distract me, it could all come back. It's all within the context of gava. And he writes, I find this line to be so powerful. Tfil of a gava, tarti the sasrihen. Prayer and arrogance are two irreconcilable, conflicting entities. You can't have the two together. You have to choose. What tefillah is all about is submission. And submission means I have to start, well, at least when I come and stand in prayer, not to be so egotistical, not to be so self-centered as if everything's about me, but really to try to sort of put my own interest, that which is so important to me at the moment, aside and focus on the opportunity that I have to stand before Melech Mafei Hamlachim, and again, which can be a very exciting, a very enjoyable, meaningful, and liberating experience, and understand that that could only happen if I'm willing to let go. Rav Shimon Schwab, in his Sefer, Rav Schwab on Prayer, and anybody who's ever attended my other shiurim on prayer that I give on Shabbos morning know that I'm a huge, huge, huge chassid of this, of Rav Schwab in general, and I never met him personally, but I've been incredibly inspired by his Torah thoughts, and particularly this book on tefillah is one which I find to be profound, very, very insightful, and has changed my entire outlook on prayer. So, in case it's not coming across clearly enough, that's a plug for Schwab on Prayer. Very, you know, an excellent book. It's available in Hebrew and in English. So he writes over here, in this particular section of the book, something very fascinating. He writes that we know that there are connections between prayer and karbanos and sacrifices. And we have, you know, much evidence for that. Chazal say it explicitly, but of course there are many hints throughout the prayer that there are connections. And he writes that just as the karban ola involves the three steps of what he calls hefshet v'nituach v'cholol ishim, so does tefillah. Now, forgive me if we have any people in the room will get a little squeamish at this point. Thankfully, I'm not going to do any demonstrations for you. But if we were bringing in carbon ola today, after shechting the animal, we would do the following. Hefshet, which means the animal would be skinned. Nituach, which means it's then going to be cut into pieces. And kol ishim is then going to be burned on the mizbeach. Okay, so that's when it comes to a carbon. Rav Schwab says something over here which is so profound. And I ask you, because we're nearing the end of tonight's year, I ask you maybe to hold on to this for the next week until we get together again and see if this is something which we can at least relate to tangibly on some level, which gives us some sense of what we're supposed to be doing. First, he says, in comparing this to prayer, is hefshet, which means we are mentally to practice hafshatas hagashmias, which means shedding ourselves, skinning ourselves, not literally, of course, but of our physicality. This means that we are to withdraw from the external physical existence into our own inner self. We are to disregard our outer physical frame while our inner spiritual true self is communicating with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The transient physical aspect of the human being that cannot be seen in the mirror is not the real person, but merely a capsule of one's real self. Excuse me, that can be seen is not the real person, merely a capsule of one's real self. Our outward appearance is similar to the hands of a clock, which is only its external feature. However, these hands are controlled by a very complicated system of wheels and movements which are hidden. The external manifestations of the human being are to be removed during tefillah. This is what he calls the hefshet. And when he say, when he begins with the words, which we'll begin to look at next week, Hashem sefasai tiftach, when I say, God, help me open my lips, that's what I'm asking for. Help me to shed myself of my physicality and let me communicate with you on a spiritual level. Second, what's the second stage of the preparation for the karbon is what's called nituach. And this, he says, is what the Shulchan Aruch means when he says that when a person davens, he should concentrate on humbling thoughts as he stands before the Ribono Shalom. This is similar to nituach, as we appear before HaKadosh Baruch Hu with a lev nishbar, a broken and humble heart. It's as if we're supposed to cut ourselves into pieces. How could I stand before God and think only about a business deal, or think only about what I'm going to have for dinner that night, or think about all the people I need to get back to? Right now I'm standing before God, I should cut myself into pieces. What does that mean? It means I should, again, have a lev nishbar, a broken heart, that a person should feel as if he's standing before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as the Mechaber and Shulchan Aruch writes. I don't want to throw you all over the place over here, but in source number 9, it's the Dinah Shulchan Aruch, Yispalel derech tachanunim, ki rosh ha-mavakesh b'pesach. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, you should never know of this, but imagine that when I'm davening before God, not only for an Eil on Yom Kippur, every time, we're going to daven Maariv for some of you in a few minutes, I should stand before HaKadosh Baruch Hu as if I'm a poor person standing at the door. Please give me something. Ubenachas. And it should be from a place of sweetness, of serenity. It shouldn't be like a person who's in a rush and he's got to go and I got to finish because I got to get away. That's not the attitude that a person should have. And this, Rav Schwab says, is symbolized by the process of nituach, of cutting up the animal, the carbon. And finally, is the kalal ishim, which means the fiery enthusiasm, which corresponds to the kalal ishim. One should feel exhilarated to be fortunate enough to be chosen by HaKadosh Baruch Hu as part of Klal Yisrael, and to say the words of his Nevi'im and Chachamim together with the rest of Klal Yisrael. And with this frame of mind, we say Baruch Atah Hashem. Rav Schwab says that the preparation for prayer is very similar to the way that we prepare a carbon. There's first the hefshet, the skinning, which is a necessary prerequisite. And again, I've really been trying, because I try and I don't always succeed, to practice what I preach. And sometimes if I know I'm going to preach, I practice beforehand just so I can justify standing and preaching. So for the last few days, I've really been trying hard to do just this, to skin myself, you forgive me, before I daven, and to shed myself of, and it's not easy, but I'm telling you, within a few tries, you see the difference. You see it's an incredible difference, a discernible difference, without focusing at all on what the words mean, and I still haven't learned any new chidushim in the brachos. That's not what's most important right now. It's just trying to come up with a way to clear my mind and to clear my heart to whatever extent possible. You're going to get distracted. If you can do it, go from beginning to end, you are a superman or superwoman. Wow, you don't belong here. Or you belong up here and I belong sitting down listening to you. That's incredible if you can do that. You probably can't. And you're going to get distracted. But at least see how far you can get. And if it's only through Baruch Atah Hashem, you'll feel the difference. Just to be able to say those words, and at that moment there was nothing else on my mind, is a tremendous accomplishment. And again, we have to realize that the world that we live in works against us. And again, it's unfortunate, but we've created a world in which it's very difficult to reflect ever, and to really, really shut ourselves down. But we have to be that much more proactive if we're going to succeed at what we're doing. Because we're going to be spending much time over the next few months analyzing the words of Shimon Esrei. But again, without discouraging anybody from coming back, so I hope this doesn't come across wrong, but I'm going to end by citing again Rav Olva, and it's a mistake. If I'm just going to come to learn new ideas of what the words mean, but I'm not prepared, willing to try to commit myself to shedding Hafshatas Haguf, to try to shed myself of my body, and just make this a truly spiritual and emotional experience, so then you have to know from the beginning, it may be interesting, it may be a fascinating intellectual exercise, but I would be no closer to having achieved any greater elevated and rich form of prayer than I was before I started. It will perhaps it's a great way to spend your time. I don't know what I'm competing against right now in terms of what's on TV. Whatever it is, it's better to be here. But if I want to grow in prayer, if I really, really want to broaden, elevate my soul, my heart, so then there's no way around it. And that's why tonight's shiur had to begin with this introduction. We're going to have a week. So hopefully we'll all be in a better place in a week from now. But over the next week, on a practical level, I ask all of us, well, I hope HaKadosh Baruch Hu should assist each and every one of us, but let us commit to try to really, really break through. And break through all that very, very strong barrier. That barrier, the Rav Olva calls of Gava, which is a contradiction, an inherent contradiction, what we're trying to do in Tefillah. And if we could succeed, then hopefully we have then cleared the playing field. We have now cleared the area, and we can then come in and learn more about Tefillah and what it is all about. We did not, as you probably noticed, we did not learn all of the sources on the sheet. However, I encourage you, if you want, to take them home. First of all, to review that which we did do, and please take the time, if you're inclined to so do, to take a look at the other sources that we didn't read, because everything that was on the sheet was certainly important and very much on the topic in terms of what we discussed. Thank you very much. We'll see you, please God, next Monday night as we continue.